Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Operation Confidence Radio Talk Show, America's Invisible Heroes, with Consuela Mackey, only on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome, everyone, and happy Father's Day to all those marvelous fathers out there. It's a wonderful, wonderful day, and I want to wish my dad a happy Father's Day, although he's resting in peace, but he's looking down at us. And I wanted to thank all of our dads out there, our Facebook Live dads and our radio listener dads, and to welcome you to another American Invisible Heroes. Our show is dedicated to our veterans and their families. And yes, I'm your host, Consuela Mackey, executive director of a grassroots nonprofit organization called Operation Confidence. For those who are new to the show, American Invisible Heroes strives to provide a platform for our veterans to be able to share their experiences, heartfelt stories, resources, challenges, and accomplishments. Now, I would like to introduce my fabulous co-host. Today, we're all happy as we can be to have the board president, Operation Confidence board president, Jimmy McGee. We have Air Force, our regular Air Force veteran and Operation Confidence board member, Matt Davison, U.S. Army Reserve and board member, Charles Whitehead. And our announcer, Brooke Gadaski, board member, Taylor Marcella, also a board member, and both announcers. And we have Ann Montague. She's here as a weekly host with the Rosies Movement. Hello to you all, and hello to our Facebook Live viewers and listeners.
Hi, everybody.
Hello, hello, hello.
We're going to turn it over to Charles now. He has something to share with us today.
All right. This is not a hot news thing, but it is, really. History was made when President Joe Biden signed into law Juneteenth as a federal holiday on June 17th, 2021, just this past Thursday, I think, celebrating the emancipation of African Americans who have been enslaved in the United States. That's important. Originating in Galveston, Texas, it is now celebrated annually on June 19th throughout the United States. With increasing official recognition, it became a federal holiday in 2021. It is commemorated on the anniversary date of the June 19th, 1865 announcement of General Order No. 3 by Union Army General Gordon Granger, proclaiming freedom from slavery in Texas. President Abraham Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation of 1862 had officially outlawed slavery in Texas and the other states that had been rebelled against the Union almost 2.5 years earlier. Enforcement of the proclamation generally relied on the advance of Union troops. Take it over, Matt.
Okay. As of April 9th, the prisoner of war missing in action flag will once again fly over the White House. This was said by Vietnam Veterans of America National President John Rowan. We are grateful to President Joe Biden for restoring the POW MIA flag to its rightful place where it is visible for the whole world to see. This flag symbolizes our nation's commitment to resolving the fates of those who are still listed as prisoner, missing, and unaccounted for from all conflicts. The POW MIA flag had flown over the White House under the American flag since the 1990s. On June 14th, 2020, Flag Day, Trump ordered the POW MIA flag removed, despite having signed into law the National POW MIA Flag Action November 17th, 2019, a law that ensured the flag would forever be visible from all federal buildings, including the White House. President Biden chose April 9th as the appropriate day to restore the flag to its rightful place, as it is the former POW MIA day that we celebrate. Created for the National League of Families of American Prisoners and Missing in Southeast Congress, POWMIA flag stands for our nation's commitment to resolving as fully as possible the fates of Americans still prisoner, missing, and unaccounted for in Southeast Asia and elsewhere, thus ending the uncertainty for their families and the nation. And these indeed are our invisible heroes.
Right. That's so great, Matt. As always, you have something very heartfelt to share. Now, take it away, Taylor.
Sure, Connie. We are pleased to introduce Operation Confidence Board President Jimmy E. McGee as a pharmacist. Jimmy McGee comforted and cared or comfort and care to his veteran patients through careful formulations of treatment that could potentially save their lives. He first got his start in the field of pharmaceuticals. My niece wants to say hi to everyone and happy Father's Day. Pharmaceuticals while studying at the University of Southern California School of Pharmacy. This provided him a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to work for the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs in the Veterans Hospital of the Wilshire District in Los Angeles. Excuse me.
That's okay.
Wilshire District. I'm like, Jesus. After receiving his PharmD in, he soon rose. Can you hold up?
She's going to put the little baby away for a minute. She wants to be on TV with us.
It happens to all of the big news people, too. You know.
Yeah, I know. Remember that one with that little boy came in with the newscaster was giving his presentation?
Yeah, that's a whole
And the mama had to go in there and chase and get him out of there. So, okay, so where are you, Taylor? She's going to be okay. Let her stay.
Yeah, that brings the human element to it.
Exactly.
Yeah. That's it puts the human flavor element to it.
Yeah, exactly.
Puts flavor to it.
Huh?
I say it puts flavor to it.
That's right. Come on back, girlfriend. Don't worry about the baby.
She's hungry. That's what that is. excuse me. After receiving his PharmD in, he soon rose in the ranks within the VA hospital and was instrumental in many pharmaceutical innovations, such as the unit dose system, which provided the proper calibration and preparation of intravenous medications. This revolution in science is now the standard of protocol used in all major hospitals. Jimmy McGee's wide-ranging experience led to his affiliation with the American Society of Health System Pharmacists, ASHP. Here, he was able to provide professional representation in pharmacists or to pharmacists who serve as patient care providers in acute and ambulatory care settings. For over 25 years, Jimmy McGee served the United States military as the VA hospital until his recent retirement. Mr. McGee decided to take the wealth of knowledge that he had received from his many years of experience and began to teach pharmacy technology at California Paramedical and Technical College. Over the next several years, he served as the Assistant Director of Life Sciences at Canyon Springs High School, Program Director of Pharmacy Technology at Kaplan College, and American College of Healthcare. Jimmy holds an MBA in business. Jimmy, take it away.
Oh, thank you. Wow, it's nothing that I have to say. Hello, happy Father's Day to everyone. You know, I'm so, so happy to be here. You know, and thank you so much for having me. I feel so honored. Thank you so much. One thing I want to kind of expand on is that, you know, I worked at the VA. I was blessed to work at the VA, and my screen door keeps slamming, you know, back there. Well, you know, I was able to work with the veterans all the way from, I was really young, all the way from World War II vets and to Vietnam vets, Korean War vets, and all the way to Desert Storm, you know. So I had, you know, I was able to work with all those vets there that worked at the that were patients at the VA, and also some of them worked as volunteers, you know, especially our World War II veterans, you know, they worked as volunteers there. And I was so blessed to work with them and to hear those stories. I'm telling you, they, especially the older dudes, they had stories while I was there, you know. But I just am so pleased to be here, and thank you so much. And please forgive me for not showing up a little earlier, but I took the COVID shot and it put me down for weeks. I mean, weeks. Now I'm not discouraging anyone. I encourage you guys to take it, but I'm just saying, for me, you know, it put me down a long time, you know. And see, I'm also a high school football coach, and you know, and that kind of messed with my situation there too. But I'm here now, and if you guys have any questions for me, I'm here to answer them, to talk to you, whatever you need from me.
Well, I'm happy to have you on here, my buddy. And Jimmy's been board president for several years. We go back many years. I know that he has a tremendous contribution to our veterans community and assisting Operation Confidence with our mission, which is providing shelter, all type of resources, and we're going to get that housing development, aren't we, guys?
That's right.
That's for sure. So I thank you so much. And he's going to be on every month and being able to share some heartfelt stories and some great information that we all need to learn about. Okay. Thank you, Jimmy.
You're welcome, sis.
Okay. We're going to move on now. We got Brooke. Did you come on?
I am here. I'm sorry. I'm having issues today. So once I turn on my video, it bumps me off. But I'm here.
Okay, well, I'm happy to see you. I wish I could see that key face, but I understand we had internet problems. And I'm hearing some kind of feedback in my mic, too. Do I sound clear?
Yeah, you sound great.
Oh, great. Thank you. Well, Brooke, take it away.
You got it, Connie. I would like to introduce our returning monthly segment host, Anne Montague, a Rosie the Riveter's daughter. Some of her first memories are about the home front war effort, saving Greece and taking it to the store to be used in the war effort. Their large victory garden and her mother going to work in the mornings, feeling well but coming back dizzy from inspecting lenses at what they called the war factory. Rosies are the surviving women who worked on the home front for the war during World War II. They encourage people to find them, learn what they did then, and get Americans to work with them now, though they're all above 90, to do projects that leave a lasting record of their legacy. Anne has shared with us that most Rosies are deceased, but the daughters are on a marathon to find all living Rosies and to get communities and the nation to find ways to work together to assure that they are not forgotten. Rosies did all kinds of work, such as riveted airplanes, wielded ships, made uniforms and tents, farmed food for the troops, cut metal, inspected lenses, hundreds of things, and promises that she would do her best now at 81 years old to continue spearheading the American Rosie movement. Operation Confidence, America's Invisible Heroes, are honored to have the Rosies Movement Monthly as a segment. Today, Anne returning guest is one of the original Rosies, 99-year-old Ruth Edwards. Everyone, please give Ruth a round of applause and take it away, Anne.
Right,
there you go. Hey, Ruth.
Thank you.
First, I want to ask, do any of the males know how to give a wolf whistle? Who knows how to give a wolf whistle?
Anybody know how to give a wolf whistle?
Girls, I bet you can do a good wolf whistle, can't you?
I don't know what it is. I know how to whistle.
You know that
whistle? You know, it's, in the 40s and 50s, when a good thing would go up the street.
Ain't no.
There you go.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
That's a wolf whistle. There you
now,
go.
That's how we need to introduce Ruth, right?
All right.
That's so cute.
No, I'm serious. I couldn't find anybody to give me a wolf whistle, so we need a recording of you, and I'm going to put it on the website. There are a lot of beautiful ladies on that website.
All right.
I'm so appreciate the opportunity to be here, folks, and I really think that it's important that this country now realize that when you say invisible, that it really includes so many people who worked behind the scenes doing many, many things that essentially give us the freedom to make our own choices, and most important, to pull together and do a better job for democracy. But one of the things I want to let you know about today and about Ruth is even though she was here last time and we had a good conversation with her, we never got to the point that we could talk about what she's been doing now in the last several years as a board member for us and what she believes is the potential for this country. We know what the potential is, but how are we going to pull together? So let me review a little bit of Ruth's story. Ruth grew up in a small town of Hamlin, West Virginia. Was it Hamlin, Ruth?
Yes, Hamlin.
Hamlin, yeah. Actually, my mother was born there, so that's odd, isn't it?
Yes.
And she knew Chuck Yeager. He says they dated. She says no. But for whatever. Chuck Yeager, of course, breaking the sound barrier and being quite famous. But in any event, she married Jimmy Edwards after the war. And during the war, while Jimmy was gone away to the Pacific, she worked in a factory in South Charleston, West Virginia, which was essentially a factory within a factory. So it was Carnegie, Illinois Steel that was within another factory, which was the Naval Ordnance Center. That's how big this production was and how quickly we changed in an instant in this country to being extremely focused on the war effort. So we thought we would give Ruth the opportunity to finish talking today about what it was like for her boyfriend Jimmy to come home, to realize that he was disabled, and to pull herself up to the point that she was a leader in the state of West Virginia in education, and most of all, what it means that we have the American Rosie movement with people like Ruth helping us. And the whole theme is how are we going to pull together. We pulled together then, we can do it again. It's our only hope. That is something that Rosies have been saying the whole time I've been interviewing them since 2008. Anyway, Ruth, why don't you start talking a little bit about what you did at the factory, but most of all, what happened after the war and where are you now?
Okay. First of all, that was one of the best wolf whistles I've heard in a long time.
It's the cutest thing.
I wanted to say, here's my POW flag.
Oh, all right.
I was impressed to know that it had been put up again where it was supposed to be. So I was really impressed with his talk about that.
Yeah.
And then getting back to my experience, as Ann said, I worked in the Naval Ordnance Plant. I started working there when I was 19 and worked until the end of the war. And I was an expediter, which was similar to an inspector because you went from machine to machine to make sure that all the supplies that were needed were there. And there were no cell phones and no type. We were the communications link between production and management. And it was a very interesting job. We had to make several trips during a shift to inspect the machines. And that's what I did at the plant. And there was a heating unit plant there, heat treatment, they called it, where they hardened the steel plates and all the steel work that they did. And there were these huge cranes that would go up and down the aisles, the bays, with those large plates of steel. And they would lower the crane, pick up the plates and put them in the furnaces and get the heat so hot and keep it that way for so many hours. And then they would get the crane would come back, pick up the plates and take them and drop them in some kind of a solution to harden the steel. So it was very, very interesting. All of the work was interesting. And there were women there from all over the state and women that had never worked outside the home. They had been homebodies. So they said they came out of the kitchens. So that was a big thing for them. And you met an awful lot of people. The atmosphere was fantastic. It was patriotism from the get-go. I mean, everybody was so patriotic. Most of the women had husbands or boyfriends or brothers in the service. And that's the reason we were there, was because the men all had to go to war, and that left the plants without anybody to run the machines. So the women pulled together, and they got those jobs, and we kept the plants going. So all the major manufacturing plants converted to war materials. So they were making war materials, and they had to have workers, of course. So the women united, and they got in there to fill those jobs, and we got the job done.
Yeah.
And then
when we talked last, Ruth, you really didn't get a chance to talk about the impact of the war on your husband and on your family. I think this, to me, is something that's really not recognized very often when people talk about Rosie's. It's basically about the work. And yes. Sometimes it's not even very much in depth about that. Mm-hmm. But the fact that you cared for a disabled veteran, why don't you describe what it was like for him to come home and when you realized he was disabled?
All right. While I was working, my boyfriend, we dated all during high school, and he was in the, he enlisted in before the war started, when the war was going on in Europe. And he enlisted and was sent to the Pacific. And was had just left Pearl Harbor on his way to Manila when the bomb was dropped on Pearl Harbor. So he was in Manila at a camp called Camp Nichols, and that's where he was. So he was right involved in the whole thing. He was captured on Bataan. They fought until April. They fought until, I believe, it was April the 9th. And they ran out of ammunition. They weren't prepared for war at all. So they ran out of ammunition, and they were doing hand-to-hand combat. Hmm. And on April the 9th, he was captured on Bataan and was on the Bataan Death March. So they marched them around on Bataan until they just completely wore them out. And they had very little to drink and very little to eat, practically nothing. And they wore out their shoes. They were just exhausted. And if one of the guys dropped out, he was bayoneted right there. It was a terrible experience. So he was, after he got off Bataan, after the Bataan Death March, he was put in a camp called Camp Cabanatuan. That was on in the Philippines. So he was moved from there to Camp O'Donnell, I believe it was. He was in three or four different camps, and then he was put on a hell ship, what they call hell ships, and sent to Japan, Tokyo, Osaka, I believe it was, and then on to Japan, where he was forced to work in a copper mine. So he worked in the copper mine, and they put him down underground, and they would have to dig for that copper, which he said was hard to get out of the ground. And they gave them these huge bins to put the copper in, and they weren't allowed to come to the surface until they had those bins filled with the copper. So he was just totally exhausted. They wore out their clothes. They had practically no clothes to wear. They were nothing but skin and bones. Wow. And my husband got down to 76 pounds.
Oh, my goodness.
And was put in the death house to die, because he just wasn't going to make it. So they put him in the death house, and it had no sides on it. It had a roof, and he had to sleep on the ground, and they had bamboo chips for them to lie on. So when he came home, he had those chips embedded in his back, and he would not go without his undershirt because he didn't want anybody to see those places on his back. So I would work. Well, I better go back to the first. He was liberated in, I think it was September, when the atomic bomb was dropped. That's the reason he was free. He was liberated. So he came home. He came to see me on October the 3rd. And he had to go to hospital. He was in Letterman General Hospital in California for a long time, several months. And then he came back to West Virginia. He came to see me on October the 3rd, October the 13th, and we were married on the 16th. We waited 3 days, three whole days before we got married. And then we left the state. We had to wait 3 days in West Virginia, so we went to Kentucky, and were married in Kentucky, where you didn't have to wait. So we waited that other 3 days, and that way we were married in 3 days. But his health was not good. He had all kinds of health problems, and at that time he had a little bit of trouble getting in the Veterans Hospital because they said he needed an affidavit signed by the doctors who treated him when he was in prison camp. And of course he had no doctors treating him, so he had no way to get an affidavit. So it took a while to get in the Veterans Hospital. But once he did get in, then he got good treatment. But his health was not good. It never was good. He had flare-ups of malaria. He had, while he was there, he had beriberi, dysentery, all kinds of different types of fever. And then after we were married, he would have recurrences of the malaria and just all, he had all kinds of health problems. And one of the things the Japanese would tell the prisoners to look them in the eye because they were shorter. And that way the guys had to sort of look down at them. And when they looked them in the eye, then they were beaten. So when he came, he'd hardly look you in the eye. He didn't want to look you in the eye. Ooh. So he had a way of casting his eyes down, which affected him when he went to get a job because, you know, an employer likes for you to look at him. So right. I had a hard time telling him that he needed to, you know, he had to look people in the eye. And I just...
So sad.
We did have two sons. When the war was over, I went right to work and didn't get my college degree. So he encouraged me to go to college and get my degree because I had always wanted to do that. I graduated as valedictorian of my class in high school, and I always wanted to get a college education. So he encouraged me to go, and I did, and I got my degree. I got my master's, and I had those three little special words, that summa cum laude, on it. So I was very proud of that. Yeah. And he was too. He encouraged me all the way, and I taught school for a while. And then I was promoted to the State Department of Education as supervisor of business. And I worked there until I retired in 1982. But his health was never good.
1982, that's a lifetime for a lot of people between then and now, for sure.
So I'm 98 and two-thirds now.
And well, you had a remarkable history. I mean, it's just... remarkable, and I'm so.
Do we have a minute for me to ask just one more question of Ruth?
Sure.
Yeah. Okay, Ruth. You've been with us since we interviewed you in I think it was 2010, and yeah. You've been involved more or less with us over those 11 years.
Yes.
What would you say is most important about the American Rosie movement? What is it that the Rosies have taught us and that you feel that you want to pass on to future generations?
To me, it's just the fact that we saw the need and we stuck together. We joined forces. We saw that we were needed. And we did, as the Rosies say, pull together and feel that we got the job done. And we were dependable. We were trustworthy. We were patriotic, and we just like to see a job done well. And we like to see unity. We like to see people stick together without dissension of any kind, or as little as possible. And it's just a wonderful thing. And Anne has done, you have done such a wonderful job keeping the Rosies together and doing this for us. Well, I really admire you for that.
She's a hard worker.
Yeah, yes. It's been my privilege. The only thing that I would add about Ruth here is I think that people need to recognize that this isn't the past. It's the present and the future. So when the Rosies said early on when I started interviewing them, we pulled together then, we can do it again. Truly, it is our only hope. I really believe that. And we have three phases of our work in the American Rosie Movement. Phase one is the different projects we did over 18 years interviewing somewhere around 150 to 200 women. so that we knew what it was really about. But now we're launching the American Rosie movement in 6 cities, plus all around the country and the world, really, on September 3rd, ringing bells for Rosies. But that's just to awaken the people. It isn't just for celebration. It's to awaken people to the fact that no matter whether you're from North or South or what your heritage is or whatever, we basically know that we can pull together. The women did, and we can do it again. And we can't leave the women out. And we need to start recognizing the contributions of young women as well as men who are heroes and risking their lives.
That's right. Yeah. Well, we're so happy to have you on a monthly segment. And maybe when you come back next month, you'll play that piece, that documentary. What was that on CBS or NBC? What was that? Was that NBC?
Are you talking about the Today Show?
Yeah, that's right. Uh-huh.
Yeah, the Today Show. We have a
We'll make sure that's shown next month.
We
when
also
you come back.
Have a video of an African American woman who has a great story that I should email over to you and see if you want to use segments of that.
Sure. Well, we want to see yours first and then for sure hers as well.
All right.
Okay. That is so great. Thank you so much. And Ruth, you know, you're just our little pet now. We love you to death. You have to be one of the regulars on the show. She is so cute. Isn't she wonderful?
Isn't she?
Another applause, guys, please.
That's 98.5 years old.
Isn't that something? She's amazing.
98 and two-thirds, I think she said.
Two-thirds.
Well, October. Okay. You figure it out. Let's see.
98 and two-thirds.
Four.
If I would be only so articulate as she at that age, I'll be a happy girl, you know. And right now I want to bring on Randy. Randy Anderson is well-versed as an expert with fighter aircraft. He's an aircraft mechanic, and he's has a strong and long track record just knowing about those Rosie's fighter aircraft and who built them. So let's go with Randy. Randy.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi, ladies. Just to start with, my dad was a transport pilot in World War II, and he flew the Hump over the Himalayan mountains and so forth, flying cargo. Through the Curtiss C-46 and C-47 Douglas aircraft. And you girls probably built some of the airplanes he flew. That's exciting for me. My dad has since passed, of course, but I enjoyed his stories, and that's how I got hooked on airplanes.
But real quick, Randy, can you give us a little bit about these, a little bit of information about the ones that's being shown now? Like this one is the what?
That's the... Bell P-39 Air Cobra, and it was unique. If you see in the nose, that's a cannon barrel sticking out of the what they call a spinner, and that was attached to a 37 millimeter cannon inside the fuselage in front of the pilot, and the engine was actually behind the pilot. It was an Allison V-12. It was about 1,200 horsepower, and it had a drive shaft that went between the pilot's feet, basically up to a gearbox that turned the propeller. And that allowed that cannon to fire through the gearbox. And plus it had some machine guns too. Very formidable. Russians loved them. They used those as tank busters, low-level type aircraft fighters.
And the Rosies had built these, right?
I would imagine you girls built almost all three of these airplanes.
That's right. That's what we said.
Yes, they did.
So that was Deb's Bell Aircraft built that first one.
And they followed suit.
And the next one is a Grumman F-4F Wildcat. And that was built you can see the arrestor hook out of the tail of the aircraft. It was used as a carrier fighter, and it had folding wings so they could put the aircraft under the deck in the hangar bays on the aircraft carriers. Formidable little airplane. It was a little obsolete when it went into the war, but it was a pretty much a good match for the Japanese Zero, which was what they had. That was their frontline fighter, of course, too.
And the next one, we're running out of time.
Okay, I don't see what that one is.
That's, you can't see it?
No, I got this thing in the way here.
Okay, well, we see it, and we don't know what it is.
What's it called? It's got a checkered nose.
Oh, that's a P-47 Thunderbolt.
Okay. And,
that was a pretty much a heavily armed. It had 850 caliber machine guns, 4 in each wing. And it was used in the European theater pretty much extensively in North Africa. It flew in actually all the theaters, too. It flew against a few, against the Japanese.
Mm-hmm.
And, they used to call it the Jug, which was the pilot's nickname for the airplane.
All right.
Very heavy, big radial engine. It was over 2,000 horsepower. So we took it right along. Anyway.
Thank you, Randy. That was some good information.
Okay. Well, I hope I wasn't boring everybody.
Oh, heck no. We learned a lot. That's why we brought you on.
Okay.
I don't know. We want you back.
I enjoy all your stories, your lovely ladies.
Aren't they great? So, Taylor, take it away, girlfriend.
You got it, Connie. The Veterans and the Americans with Disability Act. Each year, thousands of military personnel stationed around the world leave active duty and return to jobs they held before entering the service or begin the search for new jobs. Recent veterans report high rates of service-connected disabilities, such as disabilities that were incurred in or aggravated during military service. About 41% of Gulf War era two post 9/11 veterans report having a service-connected disability, as compared to about 25% of all veterans. Common injuries incurred by these veterans include missing limbs, burns, spinal cord injuries, post-traumatic stress disorder, hearing loss, traumatic brain injuries, and other impairments. Other veterans leave service due to injuries or conditions that are not considered service-connected. There are several federal laws that provide important protection for veterans with disabilities who are looking for jobs or are already in the workplace. Two of those laws, Title I of the Americans with Disability Act and the Uniformed Services Employment and Reemployment Rights Act, protect veterans from employment discrimination. Title I of the ADA, which is enforced by the U.S. Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, prohibits private and state and local government employers with 15 or more employees from discriminating against individuals on the basis of disability. Any veteran with a disability who meets the ADA's definition is covered, regardless of whether the disability is service-connected. USERRA has requirements for reemployment or reemploying veterans with and without service-connected disabilities and is enforced by the U.S. Department of Labor and the U.S. Department of Justice. For more information, contact Laws Protecting Veterans with Service-Connected Disabilities, ADA, U.S. Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. You can visit www.eeoc.gov, or you can contact them via telephone, 1-800-669-4000 or 1-800-669-6820 for those who are hearing impaired. And you can also contact the U.S. Department of Justice at www.ada.gov, 1-800-514-0301, or for those who are hearing impaired, 1-800-514-0383. And also these numbers and this resource will be on the Operation Confidence resource page.
That's right. Thank you so much for that information. Take it away, Charles.
Hot news. Hot diggity dog. I always say it's like, it's so hot, it's like the sun with hot sauce on it. It's hot. Today, I'm going to talk about giving veterans the care and respect they deserve. The First Light Home Care supports veterans and their families when they need it most. For members of the greatest generation dealing with the challenges of advancing age to combat veterans living with injuries sustained in the field, even active duty military families that need a hand around the house while their loved one is deployed, they can help them all. First Flight can help them all. And without exception, you can trust them to the honest, compassionate, and considerate help that they give you. They treat our nation's veterans and their families with the respect and dignity they have earned. Service with honor. At First Light Home Care, their caregivers believe in service with honor. It's why they devote themselves to helping others maintain their independence and enjoy the quality of life they deserve. They take pride in the care and peace of mind we provide to our clients and their families. And we consider it a privilege to serve the brave men and women who dedicate their lives to defending our country. That's coming straight from First Light. They offer friendly, professional, companion, and non-medical personal care that covers everything from household duties like cooking, cleaning, and laundry to individual needs such as bathing and hygiene, continence and toileting care, mobility assistance, and assistance with eating. They also help out with the running errands, organizing bills, taking care of paperwork, or just sit down and enjoy some, pleasant conversation, whatever is needed. If you think that you or a loved one could benefit from their care, speak with someone now. You can call 661-441-3384. Or you can go to www.firstlighthomecare.com/home healthcare Santa Clarita Services Veterans Services.
Now, can you repeat that number, please?
661-441-3384 or www.firstlighthomecare.com.
Take it away, Taylor.
Before you do, let me make one more thing. I know we're running on time, but as a shout out to Dorsey Duhon, tomorrow is Make Music Day. So if you want to go, I know we're just getting open, www.makemusicla.org, and check out where the free music is at.
Oh, that's right. Dorsey is one of our monthly hosts, so that's good to know. Thank you. Taylor.
Now it's time to hand it back over to Matt to acknowledge a special American Invisible Hero.
Okay, today I want to acknowledge Colonel George Day's story. It starts on the day his F-100 was shot out of the sky over Vietnam on August 26, 1967. Then Major Day was leading a Misty Forward air control flight when his plane was crippled by anti-aircraft fire. He ejected but was badly injured in the process. Not long after reaching the ground, he was captured and taken to a small POW camp. According to his Medal of Honor citation, he tricked his guards and made a break for it into the jungle. Despite his injuries and incurring more, Day traveled south towards the DMZ. He survived on berries and raw frogs. He made it very close to the American lines, but was unable to signal several American airplanes overhead. Suffering from delirium, he began wandering aimlessly until he was recaptured by the Viet Cong, who shot him in the hand and leg in the process. Once in captivity, Day offered nothing but maximum resistance to the enemy and kept the faith with his fellow POWs. Along with receiving the Medal of Honor for his bravery, his escape, and resistance, he also received the Air Force Cross for his staunch refusal to cooperate. To date, he is the only man to receive both awards. That's my story for today.
Okay, well, Charles, what about our sponsor?
We have to talk about the PVA. These guys are great guys. They have they're taking care of veterans, especially during the pandemic, and they're our sponsor. And of course, I'm going to show you a little short video with we'll plug them and plug them away. Check them out, P DBA in Long Beach. That's the California chapter, but you can just get in touch with the PVA in worldwide anyway, or, you know, here in the international, national, I should say. Video coming right now.
Long Beach PVA, California chapter USA. The city by the waterfront, where the veterans work and play. Long Beach PVA, California chapter USA. The city by the waterfront, where the veterans work and play. Long Beach PVA,
Long Beach, Long Beach,
California chapter.
Long Beach, Long Beach,
Long Beach, PVA,
Long Beach, Long Beach,
California chapter,
Long Beach, Long Beach,
Long Beach. All right.
My boys over there.
All right.
From the Long Beach PVA, that's Elmer and Dick. You know, those guys are doing a lot of great things for these vets.
Yes,
so
they are.
Check them out if you're a veteran.
Yes.
Of America, it's a great group.
We're so happy to have them on board, too. And they come on also with a monthly segment. Hey, Brooke, you got on, our girlfriend. We missed you through the whole show.
Oh, I made it.
Oh, my goodness.
Everyone.
You had internet problem?
Internet, computer, crashing, overheating, you name it. Not my day.
Well, thank you for your determination.
Oh,
and you're coming on in a few minutes, but I wanted to just give a shout out to Ernest Phillips from Phillips Air Conditioning and Heating. That real hot day, my air conditioner went out in the house. Can you imagine? And I called around to all of these air conditioner places, and they were trying to tell me about having to need this unit that was going to be $4,000-$6,000. And lo and behold, this wonderful man came, and I just wanted to give him a shout out. From Phillips is Mr. Ernest Phillips. All I needed was something that looked like a carburetor, and it was $200. Can you imagine that? So his phone number, if anyone ever needs an honest air conditioner and heating person, call area code 818-437-7003. That's 818-437-7003. I mean, we have no idea in Los Angeles anyway when our air conditioner is going to go out. This man was honest. I can't thank him enough. So anyway, moving right along. Brooke, take it away.
Before Ms. Connie closes, I would like to remind our listeners about our amazing advertisement rates. We have 10-second and 30-second advertisement slots available. Please email info@operationconfidence.org for more information. That email address again is info@operationconfidence.org. And visit the Operation Confidence website at www.operationconfidence.org and go to our resource page for some amazing resources. Also, I would like to inform our viewers and radio listeners about Amazon Smile. When making your next purchase on Amazon, please go to Amazon Smile and type in Operation Confidence in the Choose Your Organization donation box. Amazon will make a small donation to Operation Confidence.
Thank you. And as always, we want to remind our viewers that our goal is to raise awareness for Operation Confidence's mission, which is to provide stable housing with a wide range of supportive services, including employment opportunity for veterans with a disability and those who have experienced homelessness. So we encourage all of you out there to please get involved with our organization. We're grassroots, but we're making a difference. And if you want to get involved, contact us at info@operationconfidence.org. Again, info@operationconfidence.org. And if you want to come on the show, if you have something important or some resources to share, go to that same email address. And don't forget to visit our website, www.operationconfidence.org. We want to thank all of our guests for being on the show today, and also to our co-host, which is always wonderful to have involved. And we want to thank that little sweetheart, Ruth. You got to come back, girlfriend. You know you're one of ours now. Okay.
Wait, now. We got to end this right. Who was the wolf whistler?
Was that, again?
Who was the wolf whistler? Was that Charles?
Oh, that was Charles. Don't know how to do the wolf whistle? I know I don't. What about you, Matt?
So does Ruth deserve the wolf whistle? Yes. One more time.
Okay. All right. Thank you so much. We're tuning off now, but we'll be back next Sunday from 2 to about 2:10.
We have a Rosie scheduled next week who actually worked in the factories in London. And she can tell about the war in London and our American troops there.
Okay.
Her name is Dot Foster.
Wonderful. That'll be great. Thank you, guys.
Thanks so much, folks.
Bye, everybody.
Bye now.
Enjoy your fathers for the day.
Bye.
Bye.
You're listening to Operation Confidence Radio Talk Show, America's Invisible Heroes, with Consuela Mackey, only on LA Talk Radio.